We're on 1,000 planets and spreading out.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
To the Batmobile.
May the force be with you.
Who is that masked man?
Avengers, assemble.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Fantastic Forum. I'm Ulysses E. Campbell. As always, we'll start the show with some genre-related news. Following multiple delays, the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket finally launched from NASA's Kennedy Space Center on Sunday, April 30th. The Heavy Falcon had originally been scheduled to lift off on Monday, April 24th, carrying a payload of 3 satellites. Its mission: to deploy the satellites to a geostationary orbit around Earth at an altitude of approximately 22,200 miles. Though the 3 first-stage boosters of the Falcon Heavy are designed to be reusable, none were recovered after Sunday's launch. This is because they expended the necessary fuel to safely perform a vertical touchdown back to Earth's surface after carrying the heavy payload into orbit. This was the 6th overall liftoff of the Falcon Heavy. Carrie Fisher was posthumously honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Fittingly enough, the honor was bestowed on May 4th, Star Wars Day. Fisher's daughter, Billy Lord, accepted the star on her mother's behalf. Also in attendance was Fisher's Star Wars co-star, Mark Hamill. Lord said, "Leia is more than a character, she is a feeling. People's love for Leia didn't die with my mom. It continues to get passed on from generation to generation, just like my mom passed it on to me, and I am now passing it on to my children. And hopefully, they will pass it on to theirs." Hamill said, "Carrie was one of a kind who belonged to us all. She was our princess, a gorgeous, ferociously independent, take-charge woman who took our breath away." In addition to her acting credits, Fisher was a successful screenwriter, author, and one of the most sought-after script doctors in Hollywood. Today is Free Comic Book Day, held on the first Saturday of May. Free Comic Book Day is the annual promotional event for the comic book industry, created to get new readers into comic book retail outlets. Visit your local comic book specialty store today for creator signings, a wide variety of special activities, and, of course, free comic books. Publishers designate a number of titles for distribution without charge that will introduce new readers to what's happening and delight current readers and fans. For a complete list of free titles and to locate the specialty outlet near you, visit freecomicbookday.com. A new trailer dropped this week for Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. You can view the trailer on one of the Fantastic Forum social media pages. And while you're there, if you haven't already, like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. We like to be followed and we love to be liked. Dune Part 2 opens in theaters on November 3rd. Superstar artist Jim Lee, who has been serving as publisher and chief creative officer of DC Comics, has been promoted to president. Lee will continue to lead the creative efforts to integrate DC's publishing portfolio of characters and stories across all media, supporting the brands and the studios of Warner Brothers Discovery. He will continue to report to WBD President of Global Brands, Franchises, and Experiences, Pam Lifford, who announced Lee's promotion. Lee is one of the most recognizable names in the comics industry and has been a stabilizing presence at DC Comics through a succession of owners from Time Warner to AT&T and Discovery, with various mandates pushing the company in different directions. His promotion is viewed as a through line into the Warner Brothers Discovery era and the nascent DC Studios under James Gunn and Peter Safran. Some anniversaries this week, as May 1st marked 40 years since the debut of the original TV miniseries V on NBC. And May 2nd was 15 years since the U.S. premiere of Iron Man began the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And television director Ralph Sineski celebrated his 100th birthday on May 1st. Sineski is the oldest living production member of Star Trek The Original Series and directed 7 episodes during the show's 3-season run. The latest entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, is projected to earn between $100 and $120 million in its first weekend in release. Including preview screenings, the film garnered $48 million on its opening day. Up next is the spoiler-free FF review. Ulysses Campbell for Fantastic Forum. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, the latest from Marvel Studios, concludes the story of the oddball intergalactic heroes introduced to movie audiences in 2014. James Gunn delivers an enjoyable and satisfying conclusion to this trilogy. Essentially more of the same, but focusing on the backstory of Rocket Raccoon, the action-packed GOTG3 delivers the feels for fans of the series and the MCU. The film opens with an attack on Nowhere, the enormous severed head of an ancient celestial being, which serves as an interdimensional crossroads, scientific observatory, as well as the Guardian's base of operations. The Guardians successfully repel the assault, but not before Rocket is mortally wounded. The team must undertake a dangerous mission to recover critical data related to Rocket's mysterious origins that will allow them to save their friend and teammate. Can the Guardians unravel the secrets of Rocket's past before he succumbs to his injuries? Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 reunites cast from previous films. Reprising their roles are stars Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Karen Gillian, Palm Clementeef, and the voices of Vin Diesel and Bradley Cooper. Also returning are Sean Gunn and Sylvester Stallone. Joining the cast are Maria Bakalova as Cosmo the Space Dog, Elizabeth Debicki as Aisha, Will Poulter as Adam Warlock, and Chukwudi Iwuji as the High Evolutionary. The principal performers are obviously comfortable with each other and the material. They return to their established characters as easily as slipping on old clothes. Bradley Cooper, with more material in this installment, gives a compelling vocal performance as Rocket. Among the newcomers, Chukwudi Iwuji stood out for me as the High Evolutionary. There was plenty of Marvel Comics fan service in this movie. The mere presence of characters such as Warlock, the High Evolutionary, and Cosmo the Space Dog is going to excite comics fans. You will also hear references to some obscure Marvel characters, and there are locations that will be familiar to readers of the comic source material. Perhaps more importantly, James Gunn gives the audience more of what made this corner of the MCU into an unlikely success. Look for the familiar comedic elements interspersed with high-stakes drama, big-time action, and emotional resonance. And there is what I call the James Gunn misdirection in the unexpected way events and circumstances unfold. There's a lot happening in this movie, but Gunn keeps things well organized enough to minimize confusion. As he accomplished in DC's The Suicide Squad and Peacemaker, Gunn is able to leverage more obscure or lesser-known characters into audience favorites or provide moments in which we learn something about characters we thought we knew. Since Volume 2, what we have seen of this team has been either in an Avengers or Thor movie or as a TV special. But in GOTG3, Gunn reminds audiences why they came to care about and root for the likes of a tree and a raccoon. Another prominent and important element was heroism. Many contemporary projects feature leads either with feet of clay or who lose their way. Contrast that with the Guardians of the Galaxy, who continually demonstrate true heroic character. Something else that sets this film apart from some other recent MCU pictures is the quality of the CGI. Greater time and care were taken to ensure the visuals withstand scrutiny. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 has a runtime of 2 hours and 30 minutes, but the film moves along at a brisk enough pace that the length wasn't a problem. It is rated PG-13 as an action-adventure comedy. There is no nudity or sex, and questionable language is minimal. Not particularly violent, although there are some sequences that can be described as intense. I would avoid taking kids younger than about 11 or 12. This was a very entertaining movie. If you enjoyed the first two in the series, you will not be disappointed. James Gunn goes out on a high note with Marvel, the best of the Guardians trilogy. 3 stars out of 4. Ulysses Campbell for Fantastic Four. And there you have it, the spoiler-free FF review of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which opened nationwide yesterday. Today, we are talking about some of this week's news items and more. Joining me are Roberto Ortiz, Black Gorbachev, Philip Jean-Pierre, and Jim Thorne. Everybody, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, great being here.
Yeah, well, it is a pleasure to have all of you, and I shouldn't single anybody out, but I will say, Dr. Jim, great to have you. It's been a long time since you've been on the show, and as we were talking before the actual beginning of the show, the last episode that you were on was actually a focus on you, you know, so I had to break it down. I'm like, well, now, you know, it's not going to be like that last show. although I did let you know that you needn't be shy with this group, and so don't worry about being polite or anything. Just speak right up if you have something that you feel that you need to say, and we'll try and give you the opportunity to plug. Maybe. Well, I don't know. I don't know if Space Quest with Dr. Jim is the latest thing or if there's something else.
Oh, the latest thing now is I'm taking the scripts that I did for that show, mm-hmm. which hadn't been shown at the time when we talked in 2019,
right.
but has since been on 64 different public access TV stations and won a Telly Award.
There you go.
But it was a lot of work, so what I'm doing now is taking mm-hmm. the scripts and putting the ideas together to make a young adult space adventure novel, which is almost done.
Wow.
And I hope to publish this year.
Okay.
Well, congratulations.
Hey,
That's cool.
And we got the plug out of the way at the beginning instead of the end.
Thank you, Yuli. Thank you.
Well, actually, since you are a rocket scientist, I was a little curious about this SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket. And, I'm sure you have been following with great interest, you know, the whole SpaceX program. And, you know, part of what I love about this show is that we can talk about actual space science in addition to the science fiction. And now, of course, setting this aside from the Starship test launch.
No.
Well, look, it was a success. It was a successful test, despite the fact that
it was a very successful firework.
It cleared the tower.
It made a hole in the
ground.
It
cleared the tower.
And another thing is that it stayed together. The upper stage and the lower stage, even when it was coning mm-hmm. and having a problem later in the flight, and yes, mm-hmm. it didn't blow up automatically as soon as they wanted it to, mm-hmm. but the thing never broke apart. And that's pretty significant given just how big that rocket is.
Yes. Jeez, the biggest, most powerful rocket ever designed. And for those of you who think the Saturn V is big, the Starship, you know, with the super heavy booster
is
actually a little bigger.
I'm sorry, I'm a young person. I have no idea what the Saturn V is that you're referring to.
Oh, boy.
You're very funny, Mr. Old-Ass Roberto Ortiz. Yeah. Well, but specifically what I was curious about here, because one of the innovations of SpaceX is that these boosters are reusable because apparently they can land. And so, evidently...
When they don't blow up.
Well, but in this instance, with the Falcon Super Heavy, the payload was so great that they expended the fuel that would have been required for the boosters to land.
Right. Most of the flights that SpaceX does have payloads that are a little bit smaller than what the maximum could be in your mm-hmm. mass budget. And that's why. So, and that's another reason, by the way, that they will sometimes land on a barge down downstream, mm-hmm. you know, down range, because then it doesn't take as much fuel as it would to turn around and fly it back. That's another cool thing. And actually, I got to meet Elon Musk some years ago when I was working policy words for the White House on commercial space. Mm-hmm. Told him I was trying to help him, and he shook my hand and he said, "Thanks." So that's as much as I got from Elon Musk. But he totally convinced me, and I'm an astronautical engineer. I've actually studied rocket design, and it didn't sound easy, but it sounded at least possible, and wow, has he done that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, that isn't he actually pushing for an even bigger version of Starship that even before this basically release of... Because I understand the Falcon Heavy, basically, it's done. It's not going to be completed to be developed. Starship is the future for them, for SpaceX, right?
That's right. And if maybe you're talking about, there's been discussion of maybe the bottom part is called Super Heavy.
Yeah.
Right. And then the upper part is Starship, although some people refer to the combination as Starship. But there's been talk from SpaceX of maybe lengthening the Starship, the second stage, a little bit more for more payload in the future.
Wow.
But one step at a time. And I remain a fan. I think they're doing a great job.
Fascinating. Okay. Wait. Black Gorbachev, hold that thought 1 second. It's time to remind everybody that you're listening to Fantastic Forum on WERA, Arlington 96.7 FM, and streaming online at WERA.FM. We are your community radio station. I'm Ulysses E. Campbell. I'm joined today by Jim Thorne, Roberto Ortiz, and Black Gorbachev, Philip Jean-Pierre, who was just getting ready to make an important point when I interrupted for the ID. Black Gorbachev,
here,
take
perform.
It away.
So here's my thing with SpaceX, and this is respective of Roberto's point. How long did it take the U.S. to actually come up with a space program that worked? I mean, I think as much as I like making fun of Elon Musk and some of the, the foolishness that is SpaceX sometimes, they have made great strides just in a really short amount of time.
Yes.
So I do give them credit for pretty much, on the backs of NASA being able to create a space program that, while not exactly equivalent to the U.S., at least on its way to becoming that. So I'm actually really excited if SpaceX does anything. And yes, so far, the good thing, most the best thing about it is the loss of life is almost nil. So, you know what? If it means you get experts and you get like a weird holy grail, but everyone's okay from it and they learn something from it, that's why I'm happy. Like, I don't expect them to have a space program just like that. And respectfully, I'm not sure I'm giving credit to Elon Musk for that. But, it sounds terrible. But yeah, it's fun to see them try. It's fun to see them expand and do what they do. Like I said, following it, it's great fun. Honestly, it reminds me of some of the old space freaks and stuff we used to see back in the day, where you just every day you were excited about seeing what they want. Although, in my respect, I'm a space nerd, so I will always watch that. So I follow NASA's Twitter and stuff. So that part is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important for everybody, first and foremost, and I mean, not just with the space program, but in all things, I think it's important to manage one's expectations. A couple of times I have failed to manage my expectations and been extremely disappointed.
Great advice, Yuli. Thank you.
But the other thing, Black Gorbachev, that I respond to that you said is the fact that SpaceX hasn't got anybody killed yet. And,
quite true.
Well, but see,
compared with the Russians, basically, when they were basically launching people and you were not exactly sure.
Well, look. It's been a long time since the Mercury space program in the United States, and from Sputnik, that essentially launched the space age, and a lot of other countries are involved in this thing now, but there was considerable loss of life. Apollo 1 didn't even get off the pad. Okay. Lost three astronauts there. And it's even some of the near misses, we've been very fortunate. And in the most developed era of the space program, we lost two shuttle crews. You know? Yeah. So I all that to say, I think that in terms of the minds of the public, the bar has been set rather high. And that's one of the reasons why I say, you know, and everybody wants to laugh about, you know, and as a matter of fact, SpaceX destroyed the Starship. It's not like the thing just blew up. They self-destructed it when the launch went south. But here's the thing. It was still a success. And how you measure success in this game isn't like, oh, yeah, we launched this thing, and it went up, and it orbited the Earth, and then it landed. Sometimes success is it didn't blow up until we told it to blow up, and it cleared, it cleared the gantry. You know, I mean, and I realize it's a lot more fun to talk about how it blew up and
the
to
fact that
malign
he launched it on the 420 because he's a stoner and it's funny.
Well look, and to malign Elon Musk, frankly, who is rich enough to buy a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, he didn't invent the Tesla. He didn't invent any of this stuff. But I will give the man credit for having bought it and having promoted it. And, you know, essentially continuing to promote all of these new technologies.
It's not just the money. I got to meet him one time, and the time I did, he was giving a talk before they had flown back the first Falcon 9 and landed it. And he was talking in great detail about the mass budget and the different kinds of materials and all that. So he's actually more technically savvy than you might imagine. And the other thing is, not only did Starship clear the tower, but it did it without using all of the engines. Some of them were not working. That's how much extra thrust. Now, they're throttled to a point less than 100%. I think it's 60-some percent, so that they don't burn themselves up, which is why they get to be reusable, whereas the shuttle's main engines were over 100%. And speaking of the loss of crew, I was acquainted with one of the astronauts on Challenger.
I'm sorry.
I didn't know him well, but I knew who he was because we worked in the same place at certain times. So when I was in the Air Force later, I was offered the chance to apply to be a mission specialist on the shuttle, and I chose not to do that, I'll admit.
Well, it's funny you say that because traveling into, at least into orbit, like we had been doing, had become so commonplace. And I remember, and particularly in terms of Challenger, because if somebody had come to me that morning, you know, and I know that kind of thing that doesn't happen. It's like, oh, yeah, Campbell, come on. How'd you like to fly? But if somebody come to me that morning and said, hey, Yuli, you want to fly on the space shuttle? I'd have been like, yeah. And I'd have blown up with the rest of them, Christopher McAuliffe and the rest of them. You know, because one forgets because we had enjoyed so much success with the U.S. space program, one forgets that this is an incredibly dangerous endeavor.
And actually, one thing that concerns me, and I've said this before, is that I'm old enough to remember Challenger. Philip is probably from my generation, basically, and remembers also Challenger. I'm terrified that with this explosion with civilian space program, right, that people have forgotten the lessons from Challenger, and specifically that space is dangerous and nasty and not forgiving. And what happens when one of these civilian rockets, basically that is going to be filled with civilians, blows up, and basically those civilians just go up in smoke?
Well, but that begs another question. And in this age where space is essentially being commercialized because there are rich people.
Oh, I'm going to call myself an astronaut now because I'm rich enough to buy the title.
Hey,
for you.
You know, and we did a show about that. It's called Billionaire Space Tourists. And you can look this show up. But where I'm going with all of this is in the commercialization of space, because SpaceX is a private company.
Yeah.
And, you know, where previously we've seen governments promoting these endeavors because of the exorbitant money involved, you know? I mean, you know, who could afford to absorb that outside of some government, you know? I mean, but the fact that you've got, and not only SpaceX, but Virgin Atlantic. I mean, even though
Virgin Atlantic just went under
Yeah, well, I know they filed. I know. Look, no, I know they filed for bankruptcy. But believe it or not, you know, Virgin, like what? Because it's Virgin, yeah, Virgin Galactic. Thank you. Yeah, they're still doing some stuff.
Yes.
You know, this is that funky math where yes, we can file for bankruptcy, and yet. And, you know, of course, SpaceX has their contract with the federal government.
Actually, they're supposed to do the lander for the moon.
Yeah. Well, and they just, that story we were talking about, you know, they just flew three satellites up. They're flying satellites up all the time.
Well, it will be on Starship, not on Falcon. That's the big thing, that the lander they're developing for the moon, and I'm sorry.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's going to be basically based on the Starship platform.
Now, remember, they also have a contract to take astronauts to the space station, which they've done successfully many times.
Yes, forgot about that.
I'd be careful with the word civilian. NASA is a civilian agency.
That's
there is
true.
No requirement for anybody being in the military.
Good point.
So I like to call them, they're professional astronauts, and then there are amateur or whatever. I mean, but they've been doing.
Sorry, I have my definition of astronaut. It's like John Glenn. That's in terms of
now. Many of the astronauts were military. Certainly, Buzz Aldrin just got promoted to Brigadier General in the Space Force. Did you know that?
I did not know.
Good for him.
Yeah, at 90 whatever years old he is.
You know, that guy would basically get on a capsule. Like,
now he was an active duty Air Force colonel when they landed on the moon. And just to help him out, whenever people say, what did it feel like that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon first, he said, we landed together.
Wow.
You know, yeah. Neil stepped out first, but they landed at the same time. Yes.
Exactly. It's not as if Buzz was on some different ship. You know, the Eagle landed, and it was both of them.
Was he the one responsible to punching somebody in the face when they basically told him that he had not gone to the moon?
He did. He did.
Yeah, he did.
What an awesome guy.
Yes, indeed. Good for him.
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to point out, and Black Orb Ship will circle back around to you in just a moment, but I am going to point out that in the initial inception of the space program, there was this desire to use military personnel.
Understand
because, that. You know, I mean, there were people like Scott Crossfield, for example, but, you know, who, and actually, even military personnel who didn't have college degrees were not allowed to apply to the space program.
You know, yeah. Mostly test pilots.
Well, exactly. You know, and of course, it had been the test pilots, rather, you know, who had been those people who had been absorbing the dangerous jobs of testing these hypersonic planes and who seemed to have been, or one would think they would have been the most likely candidates for the space program.
And this is why I'm terrified that if we send this, one of the astronauts, and there's an actual emergency in space.
Well, wait, because, you know, we're getting ready to have to take a break, but I want to try and see if we can get Black Gorbachev's comment
in. Philip! Say Philip!
Yes. Well, he goes by Black Gorbachev.
I know, but it's a mouthful.
Philip, talk.
You were talking about the monetization of space travel, and I remember that show. I thought it was actually pretty hilarious because you got to remember, on some level, the U.S. always did that. Because does anyone remember the 1959 Cadillac Coupe de Ville? They designed that based on rocket fins because of NASA. That's right, the Cadillac Coupe de Ville. So the concept of billionaires going to space really isn't that shall we say, far fetched, because it's what they do. I enjoy it because, like I said, it puts it in your mind. But at the Brito's point, it's still the wild, wild west.
Yes, it is.
No, like, I hear you. Like, hold that thought just a minute, because, as I said, that musical cue means that it's time for us to take a short break, because, of course, Fantastic Forum comes to you via WERA in Arlington, Virginia. We're a community radio station, and we're non-commercial, and you can get involved over here. If you would like to take classes in radio or television production, if you would like to rent equipment, if you would like to rent a studio, or if you would like to have your own radio program, you can find out how to do that. Visit the website at WERA.FM or that of our parent organization, Arlington Independent Media, at arlingtonmedia.org. Find out how you can get involved in community radio, community media today. I was trying to combine those two. Anyway, look, we are not by any stretch of the imagination done. Dr. Jim, Black Gorbachev, and Roberto and I are going to be back right after this short break. We're going to let you hear about some of the other wonderful WERA projects, and we'll be back right after that. So stick with us, because we got a whole nother half of Fantastic Forum to come. And if you're liking this, you're going to like that. Trust me. And welcome back to the Fantastic Forum here on WERA 96.7 FM in Arlington, Virginia, and streaming at WERA.FM. We are Arlington. I'm Ulysses E. Campbell. I'm joined today by Dr. Jim Thorne, Black Gorbachev, Philip Jean-Pierre, and Roberto Ortiz. And when we took the break, we had been going on and on and on about the space program.
Well, specifically SpaceX, yeah. You know, what is acting as the current space program. And I was going to let Black Gorbachev get the last word, but it may not be the last word because Dr. Jim or Roberto might have something to add before we move on, because there's some other stuff. I didn't intend for this to be a show about SpaceX, even though it's very easy to do a show about SpaceX, and we've only got an hour.
It's like you have a rocket scientist here.
It's like kind of like why waste him, but I'd like to find out what he thinks about some other stuff, too.
Okay.
So.
Exactly.
What does he know about NASA?
Black Gorbachev?
Well, like I said, NASA space travel is feeling like the Wild West. And to your point, even with it, like if I had to choose between which space agency I would fly it up, obviously it'd be NASA because they have a better tracker.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just fun. And like one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting was, like I said, the monetization of space has always been there. Because let's face it, you bring all of it home, and then eventually it's like, oh, look, we can go into space and do this weird stuff. And, like, everything we can associate with Earth. And like I said, I mean, that's how, like, planetary-wise, our colonization works. Like, what is the return on investment? Like, we can spend billions on this, but in the end, it's like, we can do this, what's the return on investment? It's a bit cynical, because don't get me wrong. It is terribly cynical. But in the end, granted, the scientific endeavors are extremely important.
Yes.
But someone's going to go, I just spent this much money, what do I get back? So there was that consideration. Now, Dr. Jim, you might have a different perspective, obviously, but I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, as much as we love space travel, there is always going to be that undercurrent of money and finance underneath it. Does that make sense?
Well, I would imagine that it does, but here's the thing. I mean, you know, there's sort of the fruits of the space industry, and there's a lot of stuff mm-hmm. that has come yeah. from all of this other yeah. technology, you know, more practical applications that we can use at home and have, you know. So, I mean, shoot, if you drank Tang, you know, I mean, my understanding is, hey, yes, we developed this so the astronauts could drink. And one of the reasons I drank that stuff was because the astronauts drank it.
It wasn't that bad.
Oh, it was damn good.
Oh, that sugar was like, it's like a delivery system for sugar. It's like, yes.
Yes, yes. Anyway, though, but my point is that, and that's part of the reason that it was governments that always undertook this stuff. There was either some
China's
sort of...
China's still doing it in a big thing. You know,
there, well, but there was either some exactly. sort of... political reason,
China.
You know, some sort of propaganda advantage to be had. Well, that was the Soviets,
China.
I mean,
not anymore.
At the beginning, and, you know, I know that's kind of the same argument when I talk about Superman the movie in terms of DC movies, but the point is, Sputnik was the first satellite. Yuri Gagarin was the first man to actually orbit the Earth. You know, I mean, we were getting our butts handed to us by the Soviets for like a long time.
And we might get. Because just wait, imagine if tomorrow, because China is very secretive about their space program. And they're hardcore in terms of doing really crazy shit. Imagine if tomorrow, basically, they announced that they did a mission of landing somebody in the moon. how that would be received here in the U.S. Literally, we find out that basically they basically have decided to do the leap and land somebody on the moon next month.
I appreciate your passion.
Can you imagine how that would be, how the rest of the planet would react to that news?
I appreciate your passion, but watch your language.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Yes, this is a radio show.
Sorry.
I know. Now Yuli's got to file an incident report. Anyway, Dr. Jim, let's get your last word on this before we move on.
It's not just Tang. And it's not just Velcro. If you've ever had an MRI, the mathematics that are used in order to create an image, a visual image from a bunch of magnetic resonance signals, traces back to early radar experiments to try to measure and map the surface of the planet Venus, because the clouds were so thick that they had to use radar to go through and extract an image. And so a lot of medical stuff, the idea of a digital camera, all that stuff came from the space program. Not necessarily Apollo, but other parts of it as well. So as we like to joke about Tang and Velcro, I grew up as a little boy during the Apollo era, and I absolutely drank Tang as well.
because it tasted really good.
but honestly, there are far deeper consequences in a positive way from the research that has gone into the space program.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of us basically is against the space program.
No, of course not. We're all in favor of it. Dr. Jim got the last word. We're moving on. Told you, we're moving on here. So look, and real quick, I just want to kind of, get this one and nip, because the fact that Carrie Fisher got her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of recognition is important, and especially for women and, minorities and, other marginalized groups. And certainly Carrie Fisher had been very deserving of it. I wish she had lived to see this honor bestowed upon her. But what the heck? I mean, I think all her fans and, people who are inspired by her and who will be inspired in the future, can certainly take art from this.
But do you think there's going to be credit for all the work she goes through all these years in Hollywood, Because she did, as you correctly pointed out, she was very famous in Hollywood for being a script doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a behind the scenes.
I know, but the thing is that's not lightweight work.
No,
that's a
not
big
at all.
Deal.
Not especially when you're sought after.
Yeah.
I mean, that's no joke.
So.
For one thing, though, like, that's always been Hollywood's way. There are people who have done amazing things in the background. If you ask them who wrote Star Wars or who made Star Wars the sex, who gets the credit? I mean, that's the thing with, like, certain genres, and especially creative fields. A lot of the real work happens behind the camera. Do they deserve the credit? 100%.
Yeah.
Do they always get the credit? No, they don't, because it's like, you never see the magic or how it's, quote-unquote, how the sausage gets made, you just see the final product. So I love Carrie Fisher. I hope she does. I'm glad now we're starting to realize exactly how much work she actually did. And I think within the industry, yeah, she probably will. Publicly, I don't think people will pretty much understand exactly what her real and profound effect on media actually was. And she was private about it. She didn't really talk about it. I mean, other than doing cons and stuff, she literally lived just to be like a Carrie Fisher, like Simple Carrie. She went through Star Wars, survived that era, and now she's just happy to be there.
Keyword, survive.
Well, she wrote books, too.
Yes, she did.
Yeah, and, exactly. Mm-hmm. But in the end, Carrie Fisher was like, I got to live my best life and still be in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think it pretty much is what she wanted anyway.
Oh, yeah. So, well, and filmmaking is a collaborative kind of endeavor, and I'll tell you what, who gets the outside amount of credit for the thing are the actors.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was reminded recently, actors, they neither write the dialogue that they are delivering, basically they're pretty faces that get put up there, and That is your function.
Aren't you an actor too?
Among other, yes, that is one. That is one of my many hustles.
Speaking of pretty faces, yes.
This is why I'm refusing to make jokes about actors right now, because I'm realizing, oh, he's an actor. Yeah, I have to chill out.
Hey, look, man. In fact, shoot, I tell you, as a union member, I'm standing in solidarity with the WGA. Let's get some people paid, because you want to talk about, and that's crazy. You want to talk about the people who don't get any credit, the people who are writing this stuff. It's like, are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. Through the National Academy of Sciences, mm-hmm. I'm a consulting scientist through the Science and Entertainment Exchange in Hollywood, where I've reviewed two different scripts now for movies, and they've liked some of the things that I've offered to them.
Oh.
But with the writer's strike, and I'm with you, I support them, mm-hmm. but that means that I'm on hold, and I'm not even a paid writer. I'm just a consultant. But
you're a paid consultant, though, right?
No, this is voluntary.
Oh my God!
No. Unless they like my work enough that they might potentially hire me to be on a team later. But that's not a requirement. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just enjoy doing it.
But wait, if a movie basically is being filmed now, and I know a lot of projects are still going on because they say the scripts are set, right? But that's BS, because we all know that there's rewrites and things like that. That means that if a script that is filming now, if they basically need an observation about science, you're not allowed to make it.
No, I was only working on pitches that are not yet being filmed.
Huh.
Yeah. I was working on pitch scripts that they were trying to shop, and that process stops during that, during mm-hmm. the strike. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah, pretty much all that stuff.
You know, anyway. This is one of the first, before we go, and I just wanted to make one observation.
I didn't want to be a buzzkill,
no,
sorry.
No. Oh, I'm going to basically throw a big one. This actually is one of the first strikes about artificial intelligence, because one of the things that they're fighting in terms of the contract mm-hmm. is that the way the algorithm that is are being trained specifically to create scripts, that the way they're done is basically that they're using material that's already been copyrighted by the Greatest Guild of America, and the argument that the writers are making specifically is that if you're going to do that, we consider that derivative work, and we want to be paid. Mm. And that's actually one of the things that broke the camel's back in terms of this strike.
Well, there are a lot of issues involved, that not the least of them. And it's all very complex.
That's a whole show, dude.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. But there was, again, I was reminded recently, it is this intransigence about a very, very minute percentage of the overall profits that has caused the entire industry to come to a screeching halt.
Netflix being
and personally, it's one of those penny-wise, pound-foolish kind of situations.
Yeah.
But as always, and this is part of the interesting dynamic to it, because there's a, there's a relative of mine who is an airline pilot, and he's labor. You know, I mean, it's skilled labor, but you're still labor.
Yeah.
And there you go. You're a writer, you're labor, you know? And so, and it's that classic confrontation between management and labor. And management never wants to give up a doggone thing to labor. They don't care what it is. They're like, no, you're a laborer. You need to stay, put your nose in the dirt and keep doing your work. Keep digging, Campbell.
But
you know,
Aaron, you guys are supposed mm-hmm. to have a contract negotiation in the summer, the actors, the Actors Guild.
Oh, you're trying to cheer me up now, aren't you? yes. Look, we're gonna keep this thing moving, though.
Moving right along. Yeah.
Well, you know, because there are a couple of other things that I'd wanted to get in here before we actually got to the end of the show. And, of course,
you're being
new
very
trailer.
About this.
Well, not really. but new trailer dropped this week for Denis Villeneuve's Dune.
Cool.
Which is another project that's come to a screeching halt because of this writer's strike. But I digress.
I thought it was already in the can.
Well, it's supposed to come out in November. You know, maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I'm wrong about that. In any case, all right. So we've all seen the trailer. I just got to say, my favorite part of that trailer was, I believe it's Javier Bardem as Stilgar, because he's over there, he's telling the boy, it's like, ah, nothing fancy, don't be cute, ah, rah, rah, rah. You know, and then, of course, and I'm like, but I've read the book, so I know that he calls the biggest doggone Shihalud that they've ever seen, you know, and the look on the character's face, you know, Stilgar's like, what the, you know, it's, I mean, that's priceless to me, my favorite part of the whole thing.
I'm looking forward to it.
Wait, Black Gorbachev, you had something to say there.
I'm a Dune fanatic, but I'm an even greater Denis Villeneuve fanatic, only because he fits in the category that we love of the insane director. Because that man, literally at the height of the pandemic, when they told him that Dune was going to be installed, and he found out on the radio. Like, they didn't call the man and tell him they were actually going to have to delay his film release. Wrote this op-ed where literally it was the most passionate article of why movies need to come out and inspire people. And I'm like, this man is really willing to risk my life for his art. And I was like, audacious, audacious. But seriously, though, actually, like I said, Dune's a very hard story to do.
Yes.
And so far, I have been extremely impressed with all of the work he's done on it. I mean, Timothy Chalamet always looks like a 12-year-old, no matter what. we have a mutual friend, Sheree, who always reminds me that if you look at it objectively, Dune is basically just a young kid adventure book. It becomes a child movie thing. Or in this case, you know, the Moid. But it's just a really great story. But it is also one of the most complicated stories to try to put on film. Shout out to David Lynch for literally for almost a decade and a half, pretty much keeping Dune alive with his terrible version of it, which still holds a special place in my heart.
Okay, besides
hold that thought just a minute. Time to remind everybody that you're listening to Fantastic Forum on WERA 96.7 FM in Arlington, Virginia, and streaming at WERA.FM, Radio Arlington. I'm Ulysses E. Campbell. I'm joined today by Jim Thorne, Black Gorbachev, Philip Jean-Pierre, and Roberto Ortiz. And what was it you were saying, Roberto?
Well, basically the David Lynch version, ignoring the ending, you have a point. It's actually a pretty faithful adaptation, specifically of the movie.
Except for that stuff that they made up and stuck
ending,
in there.
Yeah,
well, not even the ending.
Oh my god, it's actually raining.
Excuse me, did I miss the weirding module stuff? Was that in the book?
No, but the thing is that that was before The Matrix. And one thing, and action movies in the 90s, because the weirding way is supposed to be this martial art.
Okay, wait a minute. Wait. Hold that thought, because I want to stick in just in terms of what Black Gorbachev was saying. All right, this was by no means the worst adaption of Dune. You know, look at that freaking Sci-Fi Channel adaption.
I'll die on the hill and Children on Dune. I really love that version of Children on Dune.
Excuse me, wait a minute. They made up all kinds of states. Like, Princess Irulan has a huge role suddenly in this thing. We're doing all these state dinners and balls, and I'm like, wait, I don't remember this in the book. When the hell is this? You know? And it wasn't at the Children of Dune part. You were still... And let me tell you something, Roberto. I read Dune when it still was a trilogy. Okay?
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
You know? So, and not that I had anything against Princess Irulan, but it's like, come on now. It's like, that Sci-Fi Channel adaptation. You know, I mean, even though... What's-his-face was the Duke. God, I can't call
William
the guy's
Hurt.
Name. William Hurt, exactly. And he was a bright spot. But aside from that...
The original... Okay, I'll give you that. The Dune... The
original wait. I just need for Black Gorbachev to acknowledge that was a worse adaptation.
That was a seven-stage struggling adaptation.
Yes. Okay, all right. That's all I need.
But
Thank you.
I will die on the hill, specifically that Children of Dune was a good adaptation of the book. Wait a minute.
Have they done an adaptation of Children of Dune?
Yes, and it's very good.
Wait. What was that?
Sci-Fi Channel.
They,
Very, oh, Sci-Fi Channel did that too?
Yeah, very good. Actually, yeah. And you have Dave Mc... what's the name of the guy, the actor who basically...
Oh, I don't remember that one.
No. Philip, what's the name of the guy who basically... James McAvoy? I don't see his name.
Yeah. Oh, James McAvoy?
Yeah, he was...
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he was really good.
This is recent.
No, it wasn't. This is about 15 years ago.
Oh, I guess... you're saying James McAvoy was Paul.
Yeah.
Wait, what are we talking about?
He was Leto too. The one who becomes a worm. Yes. And the guy... The music is incredible, so much so that they actually created the music from it for trailers for decades after that, in terms of how good the music was for that miniseries. And the guy basically is now doing music for Marvel movies. I forgot his name, but he's a really good composer.
Alan Silvestri?
No.
Wait a minute.
Okay, just to put timeline on that kind of thing. So the sci-fi version that that we all despise, except for Roberto, it was supposed to be Dune, but they pulled stuff from the later books after the movie.
Yes.
Making that convergence, which was a terrible idea, which Ulysses, you were absolutely right. That's why it made no sense whatsoever. Now, Roberto, the version we're talking about, was supposed to be a faithful adaptation, and for about 80% of it, it kind of was, aside from like some directorial licenses that they did enjoy. But I'm not going to lie to you, every time they tell that story, it becomes stranger and stranger and more complex.
Because Dune is freaking strange. It's basically, it plays like a drug trip. I mean, come on, a guy becomes a giant worm.
Will you look at this? This is the doggone thing. 2003.
Yeah. Yes.
I had never heard of this thing before.
And actually, the music is really good.
Wow. Okay, wait. It says music by Brian Tyler.
Yes, thank you.
I've never heard of this guy. He's doing music for Marvel.
He's
doing
a lot of
Marvel.
Yes. He's really good. And if you're so Master and Commander, the trailer music for Master and Commander was from Children.
Is that right?
Yes.
That was a great movie, too.
Thank you. Great film.
Yeah.
Yet another one of these stories where, like, hey, we're going to not just adapt one book, we're going to try and adapt two different books in the same movie. Yeah. All right, hey, look, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and Hey, if you haven't been out to your local comic book store, because today is Free Comic Book Day, and so make sure you get out to your local comic book store because we're trying to support the industry. So in addition to that, though, the other thing that I had really kind of wanted to mention is the fact that this week was the 15th anniversary of the U.S. premiere of Iron Man, you know, which, of course, began the modern Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I thought that in the last couple of minutes that we have, that might be worth a word or two, you know? I mean, seeing as how this new Marvel movie has come out, and people are just all jocking the Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, this movie, I thought, actually was pretty good. I thought it was the best of the three, because, honestly, that first one was real thin. I know people like it, but it wasn't really that good a movie. And so it's one of these, hey, you got to, as with all things, managing one's expectations and looking objectively at the project, you have to, because there's plenty of stuff that I like that totally sucks. I'm not saying it totally sucked. I'm just saying there's plenty of stuff I like that totally sucks, and I don't mistake, oh, that was good, with I liked it. No, just because I liked it doesn't mean it was actually good.
I'm a fan of Nicolas Cage, so I understand you.
Okay, all right. Anyway, Iron Man, 15 years, you know? I mean, it's yet something else that makes me feel old. I mean, not as old as the fact that... Well, not as old as the fact that Superman the movie came out like 45 years ago, but hey, you know, it's like, hey.
I'm looking forward to Loki returning. Are they going to wrap up all these multiverse loose ends that are hanging out there?
I doubt it. I think the multiverse is the new thing that Marvel has now. And I, because pretty much everything, I mean, it's like when the blip was what they talked about in every show and movie. I think it's the multiverse now. I mean, they have focused so much on that. And it's a wonderful plot device if you want to, bring back the Black Panther, for example.
Oh, yeah.
But doesn't that take away the impact of seeing a character die on screen?
But the Black Panther wasn't supposed to die. And in fact, I've always said, tremendous tragedy about Chadwick Boseman. Yeah. I was cut to the core by that. But Chadwick Boseman, the actor, writer, producer, is the man who died. T'Challa didn't die. And so they decided to kill my boy because the guy who played him died? Well, I'm sorry. I mean, you know, you want a catharsis, but we don't need one at that expense. That's just me. But yes, okay. So, look, Roberto triggered me. What can I say?
Yeah, my wife would understand that. Trust me, do that.
And Unity's point, I'm appreciative of you saying the modern Marvel Cinematic Universe because we all know it was Blade that started.
Thank you. Yes. People forget that. Say that for the cheap seats, please.
The movie that saved Marvel.
Yep.
Yep, I will say, and to this point, I to describe my rage at the fact that they killed T'Challa and killed him off screen, instead of, and sadly, yes, I casting him would have made it make a little bit more sense. But like I said, Chadwick Boseman was he's an icon, so he deserves it. But at the same time, T'Challa and him are two different people. And I would have liked to see a movie about that. I would like to see the actual movie that they originally planned.
Well, you know, actually, I think this movie was better than what they had originally planned, sadly. And
oh, really?
It was. Yeah, well, and you know, if you want to hear my review, it's on, you know, you can it's you can download it as a podcast. But the thing is, so many of these performers, and this is my one criticism of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, so many of the performers have become associated with the characters that they play. And, you know, so much so that they can't be separated. And even though my experience with the character of the Black Panther is more about, say, the stuff Don McGregor wrote, you know, illustrated by Billy Graham, but, you know, people who went to see that movie, this was the guy, and this was the thing. And so I understand. I mean, in watching the movie, you know, Wakanda Forever, I mean, it was a project totally born of grief, and it was about a catharsis. And there was no way that they were going to be able to recast that role and shoot something. What I personally would have preferred was, well, we're going to go into a hiatus for a couple of years until we all get over it. But, there you go. See, it's like, oh, we're just grief-stricken. We're still greedy, you know. We're greedy and grief-stricken, you know, is what that comes down to. Anyway, look, I'm sorry. Mistakenly.
That's the same thing right there.
I was getting ready to say, mistakenly, I got the last word because we are out of time for this episode. I'd like to thank my panelists and you two for having tuned in. Check us out on the website at fantasticforum.tv. You can also hear the show again on Sunday afternoons from 4 to 5 p.m. We're back in first run every Saturday from 4 to 5. And download us as a podcast where you find all your favorite podcasts. And make sure to get out to your favorite comic book store and have a great rest of the weekend, people. Take care. Be safe.